This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Good evening. Good evening, everyone. Hi. My name is Casey Andrews. I'm an assistant professor of English here at Whitworth University and also the coordinator of the Speakers and Artists program. Tonight's very special lecture and event is made possible by a collaboration between Whitworth's Speakers and Artists program and also the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane, which is a wonderful model, I think, for bringing community members into Whitworth to raise the level of our conversation about issues that matter in our world. And tonight's very special guest will tell you more about himself, but I have a few words of introduction. Mark Braverman's roots are in the Holy Land. His grandfather is a fifth-generation Palestinian Jew, and today Mark commits his full-time life to work on the Israel-Palestine conflict. He's involved in many different organizations that are collaborating on those projects, but among them, he's the co-founder and executive director of the Friends of Tent Nations of North America, which works on Palestinian land rights. He's also a charter member of the American Jews for a Just Peace. Mark is the author of a book, Fatal Embrace, Christians and Jews in Search for Peace in the Holy Land. And that book is available for your very own copy to purchase in the back here. There are a couple of tables set up on your way out if you'd like to see more information about not only Mark's book, but also some other ways that you can be involved in Spokane through some things like the Gaia Project and some other special events that you might be interested in. I will also have, as Mark is speaking, passed around these yellow pads. If you just like more information, if you'd like to be on Mark's mailing list to get electronic updates about some of these issues, please put your name and contact information on here, and you can become more involved, more aware of these kind of events that are happening. With that out of the way, please join me in welcoming Dr. Mark Braverman.
Oh my, this is a very enthusiastic group. Good. All right. We're going to have a good and an interesting time tonight. I want to thank you all for coming out. I see that most of you are students. I know you've got lots and lots of ways to spend an evening. And so I will assume that you are here out of a, well, maybe your professor promised you extra credit. Maybe not. But I'm going to assume that you're here out of a burning desire to get an answer to the question of how do we fix one of the most intractable problems in the world today, and probably one of the most important foreign policy issues facing us as a country. So, and we're going to do that. I want to thank the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane for inviting me and for Whitworth to opening your doors and for collaborating to sponsor this. It's wonderful to be in a university setting, and it's been wonderful, I have to tell you, to meet the people of the Peace and Justice Action League. They are a phenomenal group of people here in Spokane. It's been great hanging out with them. And I would encourage some of you younger people to join them, raise the median age of the group a little bit. That's always a good thing. But find these people and be with them. And there's information on that back table. Okay. So I'm here because this situation is really urgent. What's happening between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River in an area geographically known as Palestine doesn't involve a lot of people. You know, there may be, maybe 8 or 10 million people living in that territory. And the suffering going on there, and there are refugee camps there, and there is a military occupation, is not the worst suffering in the world. You know, I've stood in refugee camps outside of Khartoum, Sudan, and in Darfur. And they make the refugee camps in the West Bank and in Bethlehem and in Jenin and in Beirut look like country clubs. It's not what this is about. This is about human rights violations that are among the worst in the world today. This is about a refugee problem that has been going on for 65 years. Close to 4 million people now, stateless, living in camps or in exile around the world without even having the right that they have to return acknowledged. 65 years. This is about a system of land occupation, military control, separate roads, and annexation that when people from South Africa go to visit say, this is not apartheid, this is worse than apartheid. And this is a system that is being supported by our tax dollars and by our government's foreign policy. And so this has to concern us urgently because we are responsible and we are complicit as Americans. And I will also make the case that it is a particular concern for American Christians and for the church writ large. And I will make that case. By the way, I spend most of my time and most of my speaking not in university lecture halls, but in churches and in general assemblies of major American Christian denominations, preaching from pulpits in the church parish halls. That's my beat. It's American Christians. And so the question you might ask is, what's a nice Jewish boy from Philadelphia doing spending all his time running around speaking to Christians in churches? And I hope that will be clear to you pretty soon. For those of you who have not been paying attention, politics is not working to resolve what is known as the Israel-Palestine conflict. By the way, that sort of conflict, it sort of sounds like there's two forces that are fighting each other, right? And they're fighting over a piece of land, or they're having a war or something like that. There's a conflict between two forces. I don't tend to use the word conflict any more than I tend to use the invasion of Gaza in 2008, calling that a war, because it was not. You have a situation here where one people is stepping on another. It's just the way it is. I heard a radio interview a couple of years ago with Christina Amanpour. You may know her. I've heard of her. She now works for CNN. When she first got her job with CNN, they sent her to cover the siege of Sarajevo. And you recall that what was going on in that conflict before we intervened and stopped what was happening was that basically the Serbs were killing the Bosnians. They were massacring the Bosnians. Now, there's a whole history to that, and there probably were times in history where the Bosnians were doing their own massacres of somebody else. But what was happening here was that the Serbs were massacring the Bosnians. If you lived in Sarajevo, you could get picked off by a sniper on the hills surrounding you. She was sent to cover it. So she started to send back her reports to her managers back in New York. And after a while, this is what she reported. They said to her, listen, Christina, this is great reporting, but can you give us the Serbian side, please? It sounds like you're just reporting about how the Serbs are massacring the Bosnians. Give us the rest of the story. She said, that's the story. She said, if you're asking me to create some sort of false equivalency between the actors here, that will be a lie, and it will make me complicit with the perpetrators. I won't do that. This is the story. Now, the story that we are being sold as Americans about the Israel-Palestine conflict is that there are the Israelis, yeah, and they are defending themselves against Palestinian terrorism, and we have to protect them from the violence that's being visited upon them. Right? And yes, the Israelis are also attacking the Palestinians, and the Palestinians probably have a claim to victimhood as well, And there's a reason why the Israelis have to defend themselves, and there's some sort of balance going on here. And besides, aren't those Palestinians Arabs? And doesn't that mean that they're Muslims? And doesn't that mean that they follow this dark, dangerous religion that wants to steal our freedom? And don't we have to help the Israelis protect the only democracy in the Middle East against this threat to our culture and our civilization? But in fact, what's going on is that Israel has occupied Palestine and has been engaged in a project of ethnic cleansing, actually, since the 40s and maybe before that. And the violence and the terror, and it is violence and it is terror that has been visited upon the citizens of Israel, are acts of popular resistance. They're stupid acts. They're wrong acts. They're self-defeating acts. They're immoral acts. But they are acts of popular resistance of an indigenous population that is being cleansed and is having its land stolen from it. So politics is not working because the assumptions upon which the so-called peace process are based are false. The first false assumption is that Israel is prepared to accept a sovereign, contiguous, viable Palestinian state on its borders. Israel is not prepared to accept that. Israel is not negotiating in good faith. Israel doesn't want that. Israel wants and feels that it needs the whole territory, and it either has to get rid of the non-Jews, the Arabs, the Palestinians from the territory, or it has to somehow control their growth and contain them in a manner which is pretty much close to what the South African government thought it was going to get away with until the world sanctions brought that government to an end. In the 1990s. So that's the first assumption. Israel wants peace. Israel wants a Palestinian state. The second assumption is that the United States is an honest broker in this peace process, in this negotiation process. It's trying to bring the two parties together, trying to make a fair settlement between the two parties. That's a false assumption. The United States is acting as Israel's banker, and as Israel's lawyer on the world scene, the so-called generous offers that have been made to the Palestinians have basically been offers that the Palestinians cannot accept because it will not give them what they need, which is a sovereign, contiguous state living side by side in peace and security with the state of Israel. Now, I'm not sure that that solution even works anymore because the facts on the ground are such that there is no more possibility of a sovereign Palestinian state. It's been too carved up. If we had time, I'd show you the maps. Go research it. So the process is going to bring about peace, some kind of resolution of the situation, is not going to be the diplomatic and the political process. I mean, eventually you will have a diplomatic settlement. That's the way things work. But the process that brings that about is going to be very close to the process that brought about the end of apartheid in South Africa and the process that brought about the end of Jim Crow racism in the United States. A grassroots movement that changes the political wind and forces the governments to do what needs to be done to bring about the desired social change. Jim Wallace, the founder of Sojourners, the evangelical pastor, talks about that. He said, when politics fail, broad social movements arise from the grassroots to change the political wind and make the politicians do what they need to do. You know, and Lyndon Johnson famously said when he met with Martin Luther King and the Student Nonviolent Committee, you know, I think we do need a Civil Rights Act. Now make me do it. Okay, so that's what we're about. And that's what we're facing as Americans. I mean, certainly as Americans of all faiths and Americans who don't claim allegiance or affiliation with any particular faith group. But I would say in particular American Christians, and I'm going to tell you why. And where the Jews fit into all of this. So let me spend a few minutes just talking about, answering the burning question is about what's a Jewish, a nice Jewish boy doing, criticizing Israel and spending all his time talking to people in churches. I was sitting in the city of Ramallah, which is in the West Bank, in occupied Palestine, a couple of years ago, speaking to the country director for Mercy Corps, which is an international NGO. She's the country director. She's a Palestinian woman from an old, respected Muslim family from Nablus, which is a town in the northern West Bank. Old, old city. It was named by the Romans. And it appears in the Bible. And we were talking. It was right after the siege of Gaza, in the bombardment of Gaza, whatever you want to call it, the massacre of Gaza in 2008, when about 1,400 civilians were killed by tanks and bombs, including white phosphorus, in retaliation, reported retaliation from rockets that were being sent by armed militants from Gaza into Israel. And we were talking about how she was having trouble getting her people into Gaza. She couldn't communicate with her staff there. Difficult. Anyway, so I asked her about her family. She told me her family story, which included a story which is well known to any Palestinian, which is that her mother was killed, an elderly woman was shot while she was sitting on her front porch in Nablus one day during the siege when the Israeli army basically invaded the northern West Bank, and she was just shot in sight of her family, sitting on her front porch, knitting. She told me the story, not for sympathy, not for shock value, but this is who I am. I'm a Palestinian. This is my story. Every Palestinian has a story like this. I said, well, what's your life like? How are you doing? She said, and she told me a story. She said she lives in northern Jerusalem. She commutes to Ramallah every day. It's about a 5-mile trip if you have the right license plates, which she does because she works for an international NGO. And if you're on that road, the separation wall, the occupation wall, the apartheid wall, whatever you want to call it, how many of you have seen pictures of it who have actually seen what that wall is? Okay, good. So you know what I'm talking about. It's a 27-foot-high concrete barrier. And in that part of the territory, basically that barrier is now carving out sections of the northern suburbs of Jerusalem to become part of greater Jewish Jerusalem. And presumably what's on the other side, on the eastern side of that wall, will remain part of presumably what may become Palestine someday. So she commutes, and if you're on that road from Jerusalem to Ramallah, that wall basically accompanies you the entire way, because it runs right along that road. She makes that commute every day. She has an 8-year-old daughter who travels with her many days. And as 8-year-olds will sometimes do, they just come out of the blue with amazing statements, right? She turns to her one day and asks her, Mommy, why do they make the Jews live behind that wall? Now, she told me this story, I'm sure, because she wanted me to repeat it. It's a very profound statement. Because that kid, that Palestinian kid, doesn't know that she's supposed to be the prisoner and that wall is taking her land and occupying her country and subjugating her people. What she says is the truth. It's my people, the Jewish people, who live behind that wall. It's a wall that we've built for ourselves to protect ourselves from the existential threat that we feel as a result of 2,000 years of history of being marginalized, persecuted, and slaughtered. And so we have built this wall. But the Israelis who live behind that wall live behind a wall of soul-killing racism and fear, which is destroying Israeli culture and which represents a threat to Judaism itself. And when I stood before that wall for the first time, not many years ago, and it's an ugly thing, as walls can be, and this wall is particularly horrific and ugly, especially given what it is doing. Because, by the way, it's not a security wall, it's a land grab wall. And it's also a psychological barrier to keep the Israelis where they are so they don't meet the Palestinian people and realize that these people are not our enemies and they don't hate us. So I stood in front of this wall, and it was ugly, and it horrified me. But something else was happened to me. Something deep and disturbing and profound turned over inside of me when I stood in front of that wall, because I knew that wall. I recognized it. That was a wall that lived inside me. That was a wall that was built up inside me growing up Jewish post-war. Now, I love being Jewish. It's a wonderful tradition. You know, my mother sang Yiddish lullabies to me as a baby. I can open up the Old Testament and read the Psalms in the original Hebrew. You know, it's who I am. But like every belonging to every other group, it has a dark side. And I've been forced to confront that dark side. When I stand in front of that wall, I confront the dark side of being Jewish today, and I see the challenge that's facing my people. I was born in 1948 in Philadelphia. And if you're a Jewish kid born in a strong Jewish community to a fairly traditional family, post-war in the United States, after Auschwitz, after the establishment of the State of Israel, you are raised in a very potent combination of traditional Judaism and political Zionism. The two are not separate. I was told that I had been blessed to have been born at a time when my people had been redeemed from 2,000 years of suffering and fear. And it's in our liturgy. We pray every day, Lord, protect and preserve the state of Israel. The state of Israel. Not Zion, not Jerusalem, not some spiritual concept. The modern state of Israel. The first flowering of our redemption. So modern political Zionism, a political ideology, has been merged with Judaism. Sound familiar? Didn't the Christians get into something like this in the 11th century? And wasn't there a Roman Empire? Well, think of the pilgrims. I mean, this doesn't work. But here's what happens with that. Before 1948, before the birth of the State of Israel, most of organized Judaism was officially non-Zionist or anti-Zionist. Bad idea. Why would we want to be a faith community just like you Protestants? That's who we are. It's a bad idea to merge that with nationalism. But after the ovens, and after the establishment of the state, there was a train and you had to be on it. Now, Zionism seemed like a good idea at the end of the 19th century, in Tsarist Russia, when the Jews were in horrible shape, and where ethnic nationalism was the zeitgeist. It was the thing of the times. Everybody had to have a nation. Italy for the Italians, Germany for the Germans, France for the French. And they were promising the Arabs their countries too. Of course, they were going to, you know, not follow through on that. But it's not a good idea now. Nationalism is not the trajectory of history now, and certainly not ethnic nationalism. But we've gotten stuck with that. The Jews have gotten stuck with that. And by the way, the Christian in the Western world has embraced it as well. How did that happen? Well, here's where we get to talk a little bit about theology. And if somebody had told me 6 years ago that I'd be writing books about theology, me, a psychologist, I probably would have sent them to the nearest psychologist. And yet, this is where the answer lies. Because people and nations and groups operate according to beliefs, deeply held beliefs, that have to do with their faith. And theology plays a big role here. So here's what happened. 65 years ago, when the Christian world stood before the ovens of Auschwitz-Birkenau, they said, "What have we done?" And that was right. National Socialism and the attempted genocide of the entire Jewish people and the destruction of the Jews of Europe was a direct product of Western Christianity. You can go in to papal bulls from medieval times and read laws against the Jews that read like the Nuremberg laws that were enacted by Nazi Germany in the 30s, and in fact, that's where they got them. So that was anti-Semitism. And it still exists, by the way. So that was right. That was a good conclusion. We are responsible for this. What are we going to do about it? And so Christianity, starting with the Lutheran Church in Germany and spreading to spreading westward here to the mainline Protestant churches, and then the Catholic Church followed up with Vatican II a bit later, but you know they caught up, set about fixing Christian theology and getting rid of the toxic anti-Jewish stuff in there. And beginning a very, very faithful, very organized, deliberate process of reconciling with the Jewish people to do penitence. And so no longer were the Jews the despised of God, the hated of God for killing our Lord, and the evidence of that being that the Jews were doomed to wander the earth. Yeah. Now the Jews are the beloved of God. And the proof is that he's given them back their land. He's restored the land to them, just like it says in the Old Testament. And the covenant is in force with Abraham. And by the way, there's a real estate clause in that covenant. And the Jews get the land. Now, there's one fundamental thing wrong with that. God is not a real estate agent. The land is not to be given to one people, and God does not live on a particular mountain where you build him a house. And what Christianity did was to come along and say, yes, the prophets were right. There is a problem with kings. And the spirit and the heart of the Bible and of what God wants has to do with social justice, the widow, the orphan, the poor, jubilee, equality across the board. And so we have to take the next step. The earth is the Lord's. Jesus stood in front of the temple when he entered Jerusalem, the last week of his life on earth. And recall, this is in the can't remember that it happens twice. I think once in Luke and once in Mark. But stands in front of the temple and he said, "In 3 days, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will build it up again." And the apostles, of course, always clueless, say, "What are you talking about, Master? They've been building this thing for 46 years. They've been, 3 days? And you'll build it in 3 days? Smoke is coming out of their ears. They don't get it." And then it's John. The narrator of John says, like, we're 6 years old, so we get the theology right. He was speaking of the temple of his body. Body of Christ. One humanity united in a common communion, all of humanity together. That's the body of Christ. The temple becomes Jesus. It's a profound political statement. And Jesus was making a political statement when he pointed to the temple and said, "This is coming down. My kingdom is something else. It's not an empire. It's not about taxing the poor to build luxury for the rich. It's not about military control and suppression. My kingdom is a different kingdom, and it's right here, and here's how to bring it." And what has happened is that out of shock and horror and a penitential impulse, modern Christian theology, mainline Christian theology, has taken three steps backward and said, no. We've taken the spiritualization of the land thing too far. And you can read about this. I mean, it's not a theology class, so I won't go into it more deeply, but this is what is being taught in the seminaries. This is what is being preached from the pulpits when this comes up. The Jews get the land. The Jews are the beloved of God. And by the way, we Christians are going to hitch a ride on that now. And we will have a Judeo-Christian inheritance of the land. We will all embrace Zionism. That's what God wants. This doesn't work. Now, it's politically absolutely incorrect for me to be saying these things. You can't say this in a seminary. You can't say this in a graduate department of interfaith studies or comparative religion. You can't say it in a department of conflict resolution. You can't say it in a seminary theology class, because it challenges basic Zionist assumptions. And it's what's called supersessionism. You're saying that Christianity had something to say about the Jewish root that it came from, that maybe it was in advance, that maybe it took Judaism, which is what I believe, where it was supposed to go. Out of the tribal into the universal. You're not allowed to say that Judaism or that the Old Testament is a tribal document. Read the Old Testament. It's an amazing document. It's a gorgeous document. It's got everything in it that we need for, you know, for civilization. And it's tribal. And the land promise is never taken off the table. Christianity came to change that. And Jesus was the best Jew. And to me, it's kind of a tragedy that because of historical circumstances, because the Jews of the time chose to stay with the arrangement that they had with Rome, and the Christians, the followers of Jesus, had to go off and start their own thing. And then when they became empowered, of course, they threw the Jews under the bus and, you know, plugged into Rome. But that was the tragedy. Which is why we need to go back to take a look at that today, because what's happening in 21st century Palestine bears enormous similarities to what happened in first century Palestine. The issues are the same. You have empire stomping on an indigenous population. And the answer is the same answer that existed in the first century, which is what Jesus preached, which is nonviolent resistance to that. I had my own direct encounter with that. So let me go on with my story. So it's the summer of 2006, and I'm traveling with the Fellowship of Reconciliation to Israel and the West Bank to meet up with various civil society groups to see the occupation up close, to see the situation. And I'm basically torn apart. We were based in East Jerusalem, which is Palestinian still, maybe not for too long, but it's still Palestinian. And I have family in West Jerusalem, which is Jewish. And every morning and every night, I would walk back and forth between West Jerusalem, where I was staying with my family, to rejoin the Fellowship of Reconciliation delegation in East Jerusalem, where we were based. And I started, and it's a wonderful walk. And, you know, there used to be a kind of a Berlin Wall dividing Jerusalem in half between 48, when the armistice lines were drawn, and 67, when Israel conquered the rest of the West Bank and all of Jerusalem. There was literally a Berlin Wall of mortar and brick and wood that divided the city in half, and there were guards on both sides and the whole thing. That wall has been taken down now, but the demographic barrier remains. You cross one street, and you've crossed from West Jerusalem, from the west, into East Jerusalem. You leave the Occident, you enter the Orient. You leave clean, manicured, fairly devout West Jerusalem, and you enter chaotic, smelly, dirty, wonderful East Jerusalem. And you know what? That's where I wanted to be. Where I didn't know the language and where the culture was new to me. I didn't want to be in West Jerusalem anymore. Where I knew the culture, where I spoke the language, and I knew it down to my cells. I wanted to be with the Palestinians. I didn't want to be with the Jews. I wanted to be Palestinian Christians and Muslims. And I thought, what's happening to me? Who am I anymore? Am I supposed to convert to Islam or Christianity? Am I supposed to turn in my Jewish Union card? I mean, what's going on? And it was fairly painful and confusing, actually. One day, I'm sitting in the offices. This is part of our tour, of our trip. We meet with a group called Sabil. Check them out if you're interested. This is the Anglican Christians of Palestine. And they practice what's known as Palestinian liberation theology. They were founded by a Palestinian priest, Anglican priest, who was himself displaced from his village in the Galilee in 48, thrown out along with the other 750,000 Palestinians who were cleansed in 48, between 47 and 49. And he starts this organization. And they work mostly with Palestinians, but also with people all over the world in educating them about the Christians in the Holy Land and in teaching nonviolent resistance, nonviolence to fellow Palestinians, especially kids. And so we're listening to a lecture by this woman who works for this organization, a wonderful woman who's a good friend of mine now, who is herself a displaced Jerusalemite. She comes from a neighborhood where my uncle and aunt live now in West Jerusalem. She can't go back there. And she's talking about how bad it is, how her children are leaving because there's no future for them in Palestine as Palestinians, how it seems like the world has abandoned the Palestinians and doesn't care about them, how the occupation is getting worse and more land is being taken and there seems to be no end to it. And I said to her, Nora, how do you deal with this? How do you cope? And I'll never forget what she said. She said, we follow Jesus. Who was he? He was a Palestinian Jew who lived under Roman occupation. What did he preach? You know, he had seen what violent insurrection caused. He had seen the crucifixions. He had seen the burned villages in the first century, in the early part of his life, of Jewish rebellions. He said, the empire is trying to take your soul. It's trying to destroy your community. It's trying to take away your values so that you'll worship the emperor and worship and serve the empire. Here's how you resist. You love your enemy. And I know you have no idea what I'm talking about, but now go out and figure it out and bring this good news to the rest of the world. There is a way out of this horror of empire. Follow me. So we follow Jesus. That's how we survive. Empires come and empires go. We're here. And this had a shattering impact on me, or rather, it had an integrating impact on me. Suddenly, things started to make sense. I understood why I was feeling such a powerful identification with the Palestinians. I left the office. I took a copy of the book that was written by the founder, Father Naim Atik, called Justice Only Justice. And he tells his story of displacement and dispossession. And then he talks about his theology. He starts with the prophets. And he goes right through to Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, what are the prophets about? Social justice. The widow, the orphan, the poor. And that's what Jesus is preaching about as well. That's the good news. And I realized that what I was feeling was what I had been taught growing up as a Jew studying the Old Testament. And those were the values that had been bred in me, and that what I was feeling was about the most Jewish thing I had ever felt, and that what was about to happen to me, which was that I was about to devote my life to working for justice for the Palestinians and to liberate the Jews from being the architects of apartheid, that to do that was about the most Jewish thing that I could do. I came home ready to tell my Jewish community about this. You know, the story we've been told is not the whole story. There's a whole other narrative. There's a whole other people. They don't hate us. Look at what we're doing to them. It's going to destroy our dream. And by and large, the Jewish community here is not ready to hear that. And I didn't get, not to put too fine a point on it, I did not get an overwhelmingly enthusiastic welcome from the Jewish, established Jewish community, from the synagogues, from the Jewish federations. We're really dug in about that right now. It's really tragic. It's really sad. It's scary. It's dangerous. But the doors of the churches flung open. When I started to speak to churches about this, because that was my network now, having traveled with FOR, Christians who go to church said, well, we know what to do when we hear stories of like this about what's happening to the Palestinians. We do it in our own urban mission, ministries. We do it across the world. We take care of the poor and the hungry and the oppressed and the dispossessed. That's what it's about to be a Christian. Except for one thing. We're not supposed to touch this one. Because Zionism is Judaism. And the state of Israel is the Jewish people. Those things are supposed to be the same. They're not. But this is what we've been taught. And so, if we criticize Israel or take the side of the Palestinians, it means we're being anti-Semitic. It means we're not being friendly to the Jewish people. And after all, don't we owe them this after what we've done to them? And I heard that over and over again, especially from clergy, who said to me, look, I think you're doing great work. I really agree with you. But we can't do this to the Jewish people. It can't be on the table. I can't preach about it. I can't talk to my rabbi friends about it. I cannot take this on. And I realized that that was a major barrier to the grassroots movement that is needed in this country to change our own government's policy toward Israel. Because the answer is not in Jerusalem and not in Tel Aviv and not in Ramallah. It's in Washington. We are funding it. We are allowing it to happen on the international scene. It's not in our interest as a country, and it's wrong. And if Israel is really our friend, then what we're doing is the same as what you do to your alcoholic, you know, son or husband who's asking for money for another bottle and the keys to the car. That's what we're doing. And that has to stop. So let me say a few more things and then we'll open up to questions, which is, I think, what's really the fun part. This is about a grassroots movement which needs to be an alliance of churches, peace movements, student organizations, labor unions, what have you, to create a constituency in this country that will give our government the political cover to do what it knows it needs to do. I think the churches are very important because the churches have done it before. The resistance movements in South Africa, the genesis of the African National Congress and other groups that were operating in South Africa that ended up being armed, outlawed, and exiled to countries around the borders of South Africa, were bringing the South African government almost to its knees, but the South African government was holding out. And there were movements around the world to employ sanctions, economic sanctions against South Africa. But the Reagan government and the Thatcher government were holding out. In 1985, 9 black and colored pastors, colored, you have to learn, if you're getting involved with South Africa, you have to learn to use that word again. It's hard for an American to say that word. Right? But that's still the words that are used in South Africa. 9 black and colored pastors, Reformed Christians from South Africa, came to the International Conference of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, which is a world organization of every single kind of different kind of Reformed church across the world. There's got to be about 3 gazillion of them, right? And they have their conference. And they have a ceremony. It's not a part of a worship service, but it's a communion service that happens around a table. And these pastors said, we will not sit and take communion with you, with our other South African, white South African pastors, because we can't do it at home. It's officially illegal. It's church policy. It's government policy. And they had planned this. It was a nonviolent protest, and it was a wake-up call to the church. And the World Alliance of Reformed Churches declared apartheid a heresy, did the Protestant equivalent of excommunicating the member churches in South Africa, and in 9 years, apartheid was over. Globally, the churches came out against South Africa. The church made a difference. In 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. is sitting in a jail cell in Birmingham, Alabama. He's jailed for being an outside agitator and for direct actions, boycotts, sit-ins. He's in jail. He gets a letter from 10 white pastors. I think they called it a call to unity. And they said, Martin, we love you. We love your cause. We're with you 100%. Please back off from the nonviolent actions. It's hurting the cause. Let us work through channels. We know people. We'll get you what you need. Let's have a peace process, basically, is what they were saying. And you know what he wrote back. And if you haven't opened up and read that letter ever, or not read it recently, open it up again. Read the letter from the Birmingham jail. It speaks directly to us today. Because what Martin Luther King said was, no, this is the only way that we will get what we need. This is the only way that we will bring social justice and equality to our country. And this is the only way for a Christian to act. He said the early Christians were kicked out of towns for being outside agitators. But they persisted because they knew they were doing God's work. He said in those days, the church was not a barometer that measured social opinion. It was something that changed the world. And then he goes on to say, the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If a church does not reclaim the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authenticity, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as a social club with no relevance for the 20th century. So he was taking a prophetic stance, and he was calling on the church to do what it needed to do. And where did the civil rights movement start? In the churches. Who were the leaders? Pastors. And then it spread to all the other churches and to the society as a whole. And then there were Jewish kids jumping on those Freedom Rider buses. And it spread. That's what needs to happen today. That's what it's going to look like. I mean, I think it's the only hope. Because the political process continues, as we sit here tonight, to build apartheid in Palestine. With our money, and with our diplomatic support. And it is absolutely unsustainable. You know, people say to me, oh, so you don't believe in 2 states, right? So you must believe in 1 state. And I say, you know, I'm not having that conversation anymore. We have 1 state. It's called Israel. It's an apartheid state. You can declare that pieces of it are Palestine, but it'll still be an apartheid state with pockets of second-class citizens in prison, inside enclaves, surrounded by a dominant military, you know, a national security state, which is what Israel has become. So what we are looking at right now is the need to delegitimize that system. Not destroy Israel, but save it. You know, I say things like this to groups sometimes, to Christians and Jews who come back to me and say, you want to delegitimize Israel. You want to destroy Israel. And my response to them is, ah, yeah. Like the world hated South Africa and wanted to destroy South Africa. The world saved South Africa. It brought it back into the community of nations. It made a change into a government that was no longer a criminal rogue government. And it liberated the white South Africans from apartheid in a very different way, but the same as it liberated the blacks. That's what we need to do for Israel today, because it's out of control. And it's really up to us. America holds the cards. Why is it important? It's important because, you know, America has almost now completely lost its credibility on the world scene. Because we are pursuing a dominant American narrative, which is that there's a clash of civilizations, which is that there are these dark people out there with this dark, scary religion that wants to steal our, that hates our freedom. And we have to support Israel, which is the only democracy in the Middle East, and that's going to keep us safe. Until we change that, there's no chance that we can operate on the world scene, and that in fact we're not going to bring about a world catastrophe. I mean, attacking Iran, for example, you know, it's on the way. And our own generals and our own politicians have reported on this, and they've said, if you want to win the war on terror, fix the Palestinian problem. Give the Palestinians their liberation from Israeli occupation. Now, you know, I can talk more about this in questions and answers. The obvious question is, well, but then how can Israel continue to be a Jewish state? And my answer to that is, once again, the idea of a Jewish state, the Zionist idea, seemed like a good idea at the time in the last decade of the 19th century. It's not a good idea. It's not sustainable. We don't need it. It's not keeping me safe. In fact, it's making the world much less safe for Jews because it's an enormous source of anti-Semitism. Because Israel is wrong and it's doing bad things. So eventually, there will not be a Jewish state. And that will be a really good thing. It will be good for the Jews. It will be good for everybody. And it's very, very hard to say that these days in this country and be, you know, not be called an anti-Semite and somebody who's a hater of Israel. And the Christian Zionists say, it says right in our Bible, you want to be blessed? Bless Israel and God will bless you. Okay? That's heretical. Because they're talking about, they're confusing Israel with the modern Jewish state of Israel. And it's just not the same thing. We have to move on from that. That's an archaic tribal concept. I was in Israel last summer. I was actually in Bethlehem. And you know what? Bethlehem's in Israel. It's in occupied Palestine. That's part of Israel. I don't even like to call it Palestine anymore. It's Palestinian land. It's a Palestinian city. But it's in Israel. I didn't have to cross any international boundaries to get to it. I went into Ben Gurion Airport. I took a bus to East Jerusalem. I went to Bethlehem. But I needed to cross back into Israel proper to go to a bat mitzvah, to a family celebration. And I went. We stayed at a guest house in the kibbutz in the Galilee. A lot of kibbutzim now, as part of their industry, they put together these sort of kind of resorts. They put in a swimming pool. It's a nice climate up there. It's out of the hot city. So I'm at this kibbutz. This kibbutz was founded in like 1952 by an Argentinian Jews, probably, who were Zionist cell in Argentina. They call them cells. It's a very socialist kind of a thing. It was back then anyway. And they come and they give them this piece of land. The Jewish agency gives them a piece of land in Palestine, in Israel. So I check into this guest house and I'm chatting in Hebrew with Yossi, who is like one of the kibbutz founders. And we're having we're just talking about stuff. The next day I go to the swimming pool because it's really hot. And this is in the Galilee. Now the Galilee is still predominantly Arab. And I'm walking to the swimming pool, and I on the outskirts of the kibbutz, and I suddenly find myself in an olive grove. Now, Israelis don't cultivate olives. It's not a Jewish-Israeli agricultural industry. It's a Palestinian industry. It's like the staple. It's like wheat. You know, in the Palouse. That's olives in Palestine. I know what a Palestinian olive grove looks like. I know what the trees look like. I know how they're planted. I know what it means to walk through a Palestinian olive grove. I'm in a Palestinian olive grove inside the boundaries of this kibbutz. So I walk over to the swimming pool, and there's Yossi playing with his granddaughter. And I just said to him, because, you know, what can I say? I'm a troublemaker. I said, Yossi, what's with the olive grove? And he looks right back at me and he said, there was no village here. And I didn't ask him that, did I? There was no village here. I think it's got to be a chapter in my next book. That's the title of the chapter. There was no village here. This state, this dream, has been built on the ruins of another civilization, on stolen land, on denial of what we have done. Where are we sitting here in Eastern Washington, right? I mean, you know what that means. I was in Holland at a conference of Kairos, Netherlands, and I'll tell you in a moment about Kairos. And there was a panel to talk about the Kairos-Palestine document, which is a document written by the Palestinian Christians. And it's a cry from Palestinian suffering to the churches of the world. It talks about the occupation. It says, please help us. We want to live here in peace with the Jews. We reach out in love, in Christian love, to our enemies, like Jesus tells us. Here's our story. Please help us. It's a beautiful piece of work. So there was a panel on this. And the Dutch, because they're very fair and they like to do things in a very balanced way, they had a local rabbi on the panel and the head, one of the heads of the Dutch Reformed Church on this panel to talk about the document. Can we accept it? Is there a problem with it? And it was very interesting. The church guy said, yeah, it's a great document, but I have one problem with it. It endorses boycott, divestment, and sanctions from Israel as a legitimate form of nonviolent protest to try to bring Israel around. We can't support this because we are Dutch. We lived through the German occupation. We have seen what it means to identify and try to punish a single people. Kauf nicht bei Juden. Don't buy from Jews. We can't go there. They equate what the Germans did to the Jews to what people in the world today want to do in boycotting Israel. In other words, we can't do this to our Jewish brothers and sisters. And I hear this from, I mean, this is what I've been hearing from American Christians. Don't ask us to do this. But what I want to focus on is what the rabbi said. He said, yeah, I sympathize with the Palestinians. It's a great document. But there's a problem with it. It doesn't tell the Jewish narrative and the Jewish story. Meaning, it doesn't talk about Jewish suffering. It doesn't talk about Jewish existential fear, which is real. It talks about the Palestinian story. I can't endorse this document. And what I realized listening to him was that that's our problem. There was no village here. Our Jewish story today is the Nakba. It's what the Palestinians call 1948, a catastrophe. It's their Holocaust. We did it to them, and we're still doing it. And so that has to be our Jewish narrative today. It doesn't mean forget Nazi Germany. It doesn't mean forget our Holocaust. How can we possibly forget that? But our narrative today has to include the Nakba, and in fact, it has to be out in front, or there's no future. And I would submit to you that that's true for Americans as well, and it's true for the American church, because the American church has bought into the Jewish narrative of victimhood and suffering, and that gives us the right to do this to another people. And it's just as disastrous for Americans and America as it is for the Jewish people in Israel. So here's what we have to do. And we have to do it on a couple of different frontiers or different arenas. We have to create awareness in our communities, in our churches, in our campuses, about what's really going on over there. The Palestinian narrative has to become part of our narrative. And there's so many ways to do it. There are movies, there are films, there are groups that can come over and we can bring ourselves over there. How many tens of thousands of Christians, for example, take devotional pilgrimages to the Holy Land every year? And what do they see? Do they see what there is to be seen? What I like to tell people is, you know, what did we say? Walk where Jesus walked. You know, if you go over there and see what there is to be seen, you not only will walk where Jesus walked, you will see what he saw. You will see an indigenous population being stomped on. You will see a culture being destroyed. And then you'll know, like he did, what you need to do about it. So that needs to happen. There needs to be awareness. We need to connect with civil society in Israel and in Palestine. There are lots and lots of organizations, both Palestinian and Jewish Israeli, that are working for peace and reconciliation. There are Jewish women, grandmothers, who stand at the checkpoints monitoring their kids, basically, and how they're treating the Palestinians at those humiliating checkpoints. There's a group in Israel called Zohrot, We Remember, that goes around Israel putting up signs in kibbutz orchards, in parking lots of supermarkets, in the middle of streets, and in vacant lots, saying, here's the name of the village that was once here that was destroyed along with the other 500 Palestinian villages. We did this. This was here. And they're trying to educate their own people about their own narrative. And there are scores, there are hundreds of Palestinian organizations working to educate kids, trying to keep them from turning to violence because there's nothing for them there. And working with women and micro-industry and all kinds of wonderful educational institutions. We need to be with them. We need to support them because it stinks over there. And it's probably going to get worse. And they need us desperately. So the peace groups here, the activist groups, the church groups, it's extremely important. And finally, we need boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Go to the web, look it up, go to bdsmovement.net. It is a call from the Palestinians, over 200 Palestinian civil society organizations saying, stand with us. And it's a big tent. You can do it a lot of different ways. It's not going to bring Israel to its knees. It's not going to hurt Israel. It's going to save Israel. You will be told other things. But I think it's the only thing we have. We have a list going around, or there's a list on the table. There is a new development that I'm involved with called Kairos USA. It's not public yet. You won't find it on the net, but it will be soon. But if you'd like to get a newsletter about it, it is going to be a broad ecumenical movement among Christians who want to get involved in learning more about what's going on in the Holy Land and how the churches ecumenically, and I'm talking about across the spectrum, evangelicals, mainline, Protestant, Roman Catholic, Orthodox. So sign up for that and you'll be sort of on the ground floor of what's starting to be built here, just like the civil rights movement and just like the anti-apartheid movement. It's coming and it's the only hope. That wall that is being built to imprison the Israelis in their fortress and to steal the land from the Palestinians is an extension of a wall that America has been building. We're building that wall and we are imprisoned inside that wall. We have to bring it down. Otherwise, it will continue to live in our hearts and it will end up destroying our civilization and our faith, whatever that happens to be. So with that, I'll close and invite your questions. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of questions, and I'd ask that you just wait till I bring the mic to you so this can be recorded.
Could you reiterate the event in 1948, I believe? I don't think I got all the details.
Okay, yeah, and you know, there wasn't time to give a good historical background. Between, you know, the early part of the 20th century and 1948, there were several waves of Jewish immigration from Europe that was sponsored by International Zionist Organization to settle Jews in Palestine. Initially, they were welcomed by the Palestinians who were living there. By the 30s, trouble started because the Palestinians started to get the idea that this was yet another Western colonial incursion. And in fact, the Jews were starting to set up a system where they were going to take over the whole territory. And Palestinians saw this clearly. It started to be riots. There was troubles. There were several, of course, the British got involved, which was a wonderful thing, and sent some commissions over. And finally, they decided that, in fact, it didn't look like the two cultures could live together anymore and that the country needed to be partitioned. This was brought to the UN. In 1947, the UN voted by a very slim margin as a result of enormous pressure and lobbying by Zionist groups to partition the land, partition the territory, and gave the Jews represented about 20% of the population and 6% of the territory, but they were given 54% and the remaining was given to the Palestinians. Palestinians didn't accept it. A war broke out. And in 1948, finally, there was a truce declared. There were ceasefire lines that formed the de facto boundaries of Israel between 48 and 67, which resulted in about 78% of the land becoming the state of Israel, and the remaining 22% becoming Gaza and the West Bank, which was the territory between that line, that armistice line, and the Jordan River. That territory was basically annexed by Jordan and administered by Jordan, and Gaza was administered by Egypt. So 48, which is the year that I was born, was the year of the birth of the State of Israel. It was a time of great rejoicing for Jews and Zionists, and it was a time of great mourning for the Palestinians because 750,000 of them had been forcibly expelled from the territory, and they became refugees in camps surrounding the territory in Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt. So that's 1948.
Mr. Braverman, thank you for coming to Whitworth. I appreciate your candor. But I feel that the difference, really the moral chasm between men like you and men like me is unbridgeable.
Can you speak a little bit more into the mic? Yeah.
I find your historical analysis and your moral perspective to be untenable. You throw around emotionally charged words like genocide, apartheid state, racism. Here's my question. I'll try to formulate a question from a statement. Given the obvious and historical internal and external threats that Israel has faced since day one, and you alluded earlier to the 1948 War of Independence. On the day of Israel's announced independence, she was attacked by five Arab armies. Given those threats, is there another country in human history that has demonstrated its commitment to human rights, to the protection of innocent civilians in war, to taking risks for peace? I think the answer to that would be no. And here's my question to you. When will there be peace in the Middle East? Here's an answer. There are two options. When the Israelis lay down their arms is one option. If that happened, there'd be a genocide. There'd be a war of extermination and annihilation, which is not hidden from the Arab enemies that Israel faces. The second option would be for Israel's state enemies and terrorist organizations funded by those states, such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad, to lay down their arms. That would be peace. Can you respond?
Sure. The conclusions that you draw are based on a historical narrative that I was also brought up on and used to accept. And I don't accept them anymore because those historical facts have been challenged. So the story of 1948, for example, and the idea of the sort of the David and Goliath story of Israel defending itself against five Arab armies, Before a single Arab soldier set foot in Israeli territory, in what became Israeli territory, between 1947 and May 1948, Israeli Haganah Zionist militias were carrying out ethnic cleansing operations up and down the coast and throughout the Galilee. Israel, in 1948, was already heavily armed, and the Arab armies, the five Arab armies, as you put them, were not organized, were underfunded, and in fact, there were already agreements happening between King Hussein of Jordan and Ben-Gurion about who was going to get the West Bank. I mean, this whole thing was already set up for Israel to take over and to take control. Now, were there Israeli and Jewish casualties? Were Jewish lives at risk in armed combat? Of course there was. But the story is much, much more complex than the narrative that was presented to the world and to the American people back then. Similarly, the narrative, which is the dominant American narrative today of the war on terror and of America having to defend itself against Islamic terror, I would challenge that as well. And I would say that that's a narrative that is very destructive to peace and is very destructive to our future as a civilization. And that the narrative of Israel just sort of fits in. It fits like a glove to that dominant American narrative, which says that we are the good guys and there are all those bad guys out there who hate us and want to kill us. And then the last thing that I want to say about that is this. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. Yes, there has been violence visited against innocent Israeli citizens. That violence never has and never will threaten the security of the State of Israel, which is the third most powerful military in the world and is safe. Against what? Against Palestinians who don't have a state, who are not armed, and who are exhibiting acts of popular resistance. One man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. If you want to have peace, you have to remove the root cause of the violence, which is the dispossession of an indigenous people. And yes, it's not the moral gulf that separates us. I think we have the same values. I think we have different facts. And we owe it to ourselves as Americans to have the right facts. Well, I would ask... You know what? The Armenians also. Let me listen. This Holocaust thing is very, very highly charged. First of all, I don't say Holocaust. I say the Nazi Holocaust or the Nazi genocide of the Jews, because I refuse to claim the Holocaust and genocide as my particular Jewish legacy that I own. There are other Holocausts. There are other genocides. We don't own that. When people make the comparison between Israel and the Nazis, it's called an obscene comparison. I will tell you what's obscene. What's obscene is my people refusing to take responsibility for what they have perpetrated against another people. And you don't equate how many people have died or what the methods are.
Let's have one more question.
Okay, so let's, yeah.
I don't want to sound like I'm echoing this question because I really am not. I suppose what I would like to ask is, taking the position of that there are different narratives, that there are different sides to the issue, and I mean, perhaps it's an unfair question because of the sheer complexity of it, but in your opinion, taking the facts of such men as Ahmadinejad of Iraq and granting that he does not represent the entire Arab ideal or the Palestinian state itself, how can
Israel... He's not even an Arab.
What? I'm sorry?
He's not an Arab even.
Well, I would say perhaps that too.
I do not claim
I'm
to
sorry,
be
the Trump. But no, I take your point. I mean, it's used in that way. He's going to be the next perpetrator of the next Holocaust.
Perhaps just recognizing that he at his threats against Israel.
Yeah.
How can Israel, I suppose I'm asking you to expand then, tear down its walls, not necessarily, not only in the mental way, but in a policy sense, not just stopping, or in a policy sense, how can it become less defensive against a obviously offensive threat around it and not let the Palestinian state become a buffer zone for these malicious threats?
The Palestinians are not an offensive threat. And the wall is not a security wall. The wall is a land grab wall, and the wall represents a psychological and a political barrier for the benefit of the Israelis so that they don't get to meet the Palestinians. It does not work it does not protect the Israelis from terrorism. Go to Palestine, talk to Palestinians, and ask them how many thousands of Palestinians sneak into Israel across that so-called security barrier to work illegally every day. If a bomber wants to get in there, he's going to get in there. The wall is not there for that purpose. After 1967, when Israel took over that territory, there was an open border. Effectively, there was no border. Israelis poured in as tourists. Palestinians came into Israel to work in skilled industries, not as day laborers. And there was an enormous amount of cultural interchange, and people were going to start to know each other. That's what can happen there. That's what that can be, a single multinational state where the territory is shared. And I'll tell you, there's so many similarities between Palestinians and Israeli Jews. If they could form a single, diverse society, it would be a wonderful thing to behold. There doesn't need to be a border there, but there can be. You know, take down that border as long as there's no wall. The reason that the violence erupted and the first intifada started in 1987 was the settlement project. While Israelis were enjoying, you know, meeting the Palestinians, and the Palestinians were working in Israel, the labor government, Yitzhak Rabin, the great man of peace, was building more settlements than Ariel Sharon did in his terms as president. And the Palestinians started to realize that this was the continuation of a land grab and a colonial settler project. And finally, a nonviolent, broad insurrection grew up called the First Intifada, called the Shaking Off. And then you started to get the invasions and the Israeli retaliation, which was simply using that as a pretext to take more land. And then 2000, after the Second Intifada, that's when the wall went up. The root cause of the violence is the colonial settler project. Take that away, remove the root cause, and you will have peace.